This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
Welcome to the GHIL podcast. I'm your host, Kim Koenig, and today I'm joined by GHIL Research Fellow in Modern History, Ole Münch, to talk to Professor Philip Gussert, whose lecture at the German Historical Institute explored a compelling question. Why does street protest remain powerful in our digital age? Professor Gussert's research examines 250 years of protest history in different societies and geographical contexts. His project aims to develop a historical framework for understanding why physically taking to the streets remains an effective form of political expression, even as digital platforms offer new avenues for dissent. Good morning, Philip. Thank you so much for joining us on the GHIL podcast today. We're very happy to have you here.
Yeah, hi, Kim. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. You gave a lecture here on Contesting Political Spaces, Thoughts on a World History of Street Protest, a very interesting topic, I think, very broad topic. And I was wondering whether you could start us off just giving us a little bit of an overview of what your project is about and how you came up with the idea of writing a world history of street protest.
Yeah, as you said, it's a world history of street protests, which is quite an ambitious project, I have to say, and I may have underestimated the complexity of the project myself. So if you would ask me today, maybe I would not really start it again. But since I'm already in the middle of the work, I think I have now bring it to a good end. So yes, the idea is, and it comes from a present perspective, obviously, because there is a certain repertoire, there's a certain way how people are expressing themselves in dissent going into the streets. And I wonder how what we take as a natural way of expressing dissent and protest outside the enclosed spaces of our buildings, how that has developed over several centuries. I think that the repertoire that we take as a given is actually one that has developed. And I think there were different ways over the centuries how people were articulating political and social dissent. So I think that what we take for granted needs to be historicized and needs to be seen as something that came about as the result of a long historical development.
What's the period that you're looking at?
I'll start with the late 18th century, so the period of the transatlantic revolutions, but also that period is interesting because we find in Qing China a period in which there is a development or new developments in the Middle Qing dynasty. There is new developments in how people go about, you know, expressing dissent under very different cultural and political circumstances, if you compare it to late 18th century Europe. But I find that the late 18th century or the middle to late 18th century is a very interesting period to start with. It's quite obvious if you come at it from a European or transatlantic point of view. It seems less obvious if you look at it from an East Asian point of view.
So besides the historical change and a spatial change or spatial differences you just mapped, what really struck me when I was reading your abstract for your talk is that it's still important to take protest to the streets, right? So it's not the same as online protest. There's something unique about people meeting in an urban space and physically sharing their anger or indignation or whatnot. And as it happens, I recently read Andreas Pettenkofer's books about radical protest movements and the Green Movement in Germany. Pettenkofer is a sociologist, and he makes a somewhat related claim by saying that the whole Green Movement was very much fueled by the experience of being a physical part of a protesting crowd, and that this really motivated the actors. And I think you have also written quite a lot about the new social movements as a historian. So I would like to ask you maybe bold or counterfactual question. Do you think that there would be a Green Party in Germany today if its early protagonists had met online? Would have made a difference?
Well, that's really an important question and also a provocative one, as you say. And yes, I'm not convinced, you know, although we see new parties forming these days in Germany, under the circumstances of our German political system, of course, it's more easy to form new political parties or for new political parties to be successful in parliamentary elections. So we have seen the Bündnis Sarah Wagenknecht, we have seen the Alternative für Deutschland, and Alternative für Deutschland in particular also has a street protest wing, so to say, you know. So even under the conditions of a totally digitalized public sphere, we see new parties emerging, yes. But right, for the Green Movement, two events were central. The protest against nuclear energy on the one hand and the peace movement of the 1980s on the other. And both are intimately related through performing dissent in the streets. And I wonder, in response to Kim's question, I didn't really make that point that you now, Ole, brought up. Why does it not disappear from the world? Because that's normally the question I start with, being a contemporary historian, and I find that fascinating. But then it makes sense, you know, to go back several centuries, because if you start with the French Revolution or the Middle Qing Dynasty or whatever, 200, 250 years back, you will see that there have been several media revolutions. And despite the transformation of the public sphere in the 19th century, when mass circulation dailies were emerging, or then in the 20th century have seen radio and later television after World War II becoming really the lead medium, it did not mean that people felt that they no longer needed to go into the streets. And so it is not surprising that in a media environment that is being shaped by social media, as we tend to call them nowadays, street protests, being outraged and going into the streets, is not disappearing. You know, it wasn't wiped out by radio. It wasn't wiped out by television. Why should it be wiped out by social media?
But did it change when radio came up or newspapers? Did it affect each other, these two media, so to say?
Yes. So we live under, maybe it's an illusion, but we always think, you know, we are still doing it the same way the sans-culottes during the French Revolution were going into the streets. And there are differences. And some of these differences have to do with the particular media environment. I think as social media were becoming really important during the early 21st century, so the 0 years, the teens, 2011, you know, Arab Spring and Occupy, you saw more protesters being engaged in the occupation of physical spaces. That does not mean that we didn't have that before. We mentioned the environment movement of the 1970s, the anti-nuclear energy movement of the 1970s, they also occupied construction sites of atomic energy reactors. So it has always been there, and there have been the sit-in strikes in the 1930s in the United States and the motor industry and so on. But in recent decades, occupying spaces for several days, sometimes months on time, have become more prominent. Another example for a particular way of going into the streets that has disappeared are long distance marches. I'm not saying that there are no long distance marches at all. You know, we still have them nowadays, but they are less prominent than they were during the first half of the 20th century, especially in America. We always remember the civil rights marches of the 1960s, but they come toward the end of a tradition of staging long-distance marches. Unemployed people in Great Britain were engaged in that. It was a colonial practice in the British Empire. Think of Gandhi, who started that in South Africa in the early 20th century. And we have it all over in America during the first half of the 20th century as well. And it was particularly well adapted to a media environment where you have localized print presses, where you don't really have large national media systems like we take them for granted nowadays, but especially in America, but also in South Africa or India for that matter, you had regional media systems which were on print. So if you march, you know, from one city to the next and you do that for several weeks or even months, it means that in each local community, you will have reporters out writing about that group that was marching for their small town, often reaching only several thousand people because these were small newspapers, but that was the medium of the day. And so these long distance marches are well adapted to fragmented print media markets, which then disappear as television and radio come along in the middle of the 20th century.
It's really interesting. I was going to come back to, you were talking about very, obviously it's the world history, so you're looking at very different countries and cultural contexts. I was wondering if there's something universal that you observe in the practices of protest that you're looking at, or whether we have a very Western idea of what protest is. Yeah, I was wondering how you unite these different approaches to protest and if you see any similarities or very unusual differences, perhaps.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. And being from a Western country and having been raised in a Western historiographical or German historiographical tradition, it's always difficult to see whether what I'm doing, what I'm writing is parochial or not. But what I think is really universal is that function of the body, and that the body, in a way, it's not independent of your culture, but the body as something that is vulnerable and something that can be put out there in dissent always is a strong sign. And that is independent from the particular time period or from the particular culture in which you are protest or political system. So that does not mean that how we react to these bad bodies or how these bodies are being framed is independent of the particular culture, whether it is a Western or Eastern Asian country or whatever. You know, that, of course, is culturally and politically specific. Also, it makes a difference whether I put my body out in a dictatorship or in a liberal democracy. So in dictatorships, of course, these kind of activities are banned. And so the wahrscheinlichkeit, the probability of going to jail is a very large one. And so that, of course, you know, makes a difference. But still, a vulnerable human body, which is a very vulnerable thing out there in the streets, you know, it works, you know, whether it is Russia today or whether it is Green China in the 1760s of our time. So I think that signal that human beings are sending to other human beings is always working. But what we are reading into it, how we talk about, you know, what we are observing, that of course is culturally and historically specific.
Very interesting. Putting yourself on the line, so to say. I was wondering, have you yourself been involved in protests in the past?
Yes, but not very, very actively. I took part in a demonstration during the 1980s. So basically, I was involved in some protests during 1980s that was related to a testing course and infrastructure project that some large motor company in Germany did during the 1980s. And later on, I had, you know, more or less a little bit of experience that was related to protests about the funding of German universities and higher education, and then the recent pro-democracy protests that came up in Germany at the beginning of 24. Mm-hmm. So that's my rather short-lived career as a protester myself. As part of that project, I have, however, went to several demonstrations, but more as an observer. So I was not doing it because I was siding with these demonstrators, but I think it is also important to observe, you know, to be part of the thing. Of course, I cannot go back to the 19th century, to, you know, pre-revolutionary Germany or to America during the Jacksonian. That's not possible.
Be nice.
No, it'd be nice, yes. I have some time machine there. But I observed some climate protests, of the Fridays for Future demonstrations. I observed them in my place where I live. I went to see the last generation protests in Germany. Also looked at the right-wing protests of Pegida in Dresden a couple of years ago, because as a protest historian, I think you have to look at all sides, regardless of my own politics and whom I'm sympathizing with. It is really quite interesting to be there, to walk with people. And of course, they would not really recognize that some of me being an observer, but I want to make clear that to these particular protests, I went as an observer and not as someone who was really involved in the politics of that group. Which I have to say when it comes to Pegida, obviously. but I walked with them for Dresden. I thought it was important to see.
And I think just last but not least, perhaps, I always ask this question, which I know is not a favorite, but looking towards the future, we've talked a lot about social media and about embodiment and kind of what it means to be in a space together. But I was wondering whether you think that the online space can become part of these scripts of protest, maybe also in terms of, you were talking about different media and how they respond to protest or accompany protest, whether social media and the kind of the immediacy of it can become part of this. Because I know that now you also say we can be wonderfully outraged online immediately. And I was wondering and how far you think that can feature into a future.
Interesting, Kim, you are asking the questions that the journalists are always asking, you know, looking into the future, and I'm trying to be coherent in English as well as I can, you know. But the first point would be, yes, obviously, the way we communicate, the medium that we use to communicate, it changes what happens in the physical space, you know, what happens with the bodies, you know. It's not separate from each other. Second point, the way in which people organize has dramatically changed. Really, as with many other parts of our social reality and of our life, it now is much easier to organize something. Something can go viral very easily that would have taken a lot more time and effort even 30 or 40 years back, you know. So when you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, the climate protests, we have seen all of that, you know, and it really means that young people can organize very quickly. It also means that things can die down rather quickly because the organizational structures are different. So there's always an upside and a downside to that, you know. And social media are here to stay. They are not going to disappear. At some point, they will supersede it by something else, something new. And, you know, as social media are coming up, it doesn't mean that television has totally disappeared, you know. It's still there. It's a factor. People also still want to get into the evening news. So if there is a feature on a particular event that happens on Trafalgar Squares, and if the BBC is reporting about it, it's a sign of the impact that you are making. So even though people are more or less living in a space, a media space created by social media, and, you know, mostly connect to these media, they still see that something has really hit a mark, you know, has really become important if the traditional media are writing about it. So there's a symbiosis, and old media are not just disappearing. So what I expect for the future is that actually the intensity of protests may increase because it's more easy to organize. At the same time, people also might get bored more easily, or the impact may be less than it used to be because the thresholds are just lower, you know. But again, think about the basic distinction that I made before. You know, it depends on whether you live in an open or free society or whether it is a closed dictatorship. I remember the Belarus protests a couple of years ago, which actually also would not have been possible without social media, you know, but people were put into prison and basically the movement died. So these differences also persist of the legal and political and social context that impedes you from protesting or that supports you in going into the streets independently of the particular medium that people are using.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Really interesting interview. I'm really excited to see what kind of history you will be writing in your book. And we were very lucky to have you here and look forward to hearing more from you. But in the meantime, we hope our listeners enjoy this interview as much as we did. And of course, also listen to your lecture.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you and also speaking at the GHI London.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.